Hello, it's me again, Mr. Brad Rao from BradRaoMusic.com. Welcome, and today we're going to be talking about the greatest musician in the world, Johann Sebastian Bach. It is not just my opinion that Bach is the greatest composer or the greatest classical composer. In fact, I think it was Time magazine that, or one of them that voted, at least in this particular era of time, that Bach was the greatest classical composer. And it's interesting why that is, because if you look at the history of Bach, Bach hasn't actually really innovated hardly anything. A little bit of backstory on Bach is there was a style of music called Baroque. And actually there was a word, Baroque, and Baroque meant decorated or highly ornamented. An ornament, of course, is a little decoration. An ornament is something you put onto something else to decorate it, to make it look even nicer than before. And the Baroque art looked a lot like the doodles that I would make in English class when I was in high school. These very intricate, detailed little things that from far away really resembled nothing, but from up close had unbelievable detail and weird twisting, turning kind of things. And the Baroque music really also embodied this very intricate, highly ornamented, highly decorated style. Eventually, as things go, we're going to have a lecture called The History of Music, and we're going to, we'll talk about this a little bit more, things get so in style that they end up becoming out of style. The best way to get something out of style is to have everybody doing it, and then wait 5 minutes, and then you'll never see anyone do it again, until someone gets sick of something else. By the time that Bach was writing music, or I shouldn't say, in a very vague sense, towards the end of his life, there was the new gallant classical style, which really, in a lot of ways, resembled rock and roll. It was a lot simpler, it was a lot more fun, it was kind of more louder, it was a little bit more shocking. You would kind of wear your hair back, and it was sort of a rebellion against this Baroque style, this highly detailed, ornamented thing. Very simple, classical style. There's one ornament. That's as ornamented as Mozart is. Bach's music, on the other hand, very, very ornamented, very detailed, very busy, very complicated. By the time that Bach was writing music towards the end of his life, Baroque actually became an insult. To say something was Baroque would, you know, ew, that's funky smelling. Ah, what a terrible thing. How funky, you know. of course, anyone who knows me knows that I love funk, and funk is the greatest style of music in the world. But right now we're talking about the greatest musician in the world, Johann Sebastian Bach. So he was writing in this funky, Baroque style that was totally like, ew, you're doing, you know, it would be like dressing like Michael Jackson in the middle of Kurt Cobain's 90s revolution against the 80s. It was this, you know, he kept it going longer while everyone else already moved on to something else. And he was writing fugues. He was the only person writing fugues. No one else were, you know, fugues were almost more Renaissance. Fugues, let me correct myself, because I know somebody's going to be like, what did you just say? The fugues have its beginning in the Renaissance counterpoint, and the canon kind of style that it developed into the Baroque music. And by the time the classical musicians were writing music, the fugue was nothing. The classical musicians, as a contrast, were writing in writing music based on two different themes, and the themes were contrasting. The first one might be in minor, the second one was in major. And then the development mixes them together, and then, you know, where one is in major and the other's in minor. Or maybe they're both major, but one has a different character and is a fast staccato, you know, hopping around, energetic, witty melody, and the other melody is slow and low and clumsy and can't even quite make it on time to some of those bound beats. So we have this variety of two themes, where in Bach's music, there was one theme that was going pretty much the entire time, and it was just continuously developing as far as it could go, as far as he could push it. And he was already taking a style. He was already taking the dead horse, resurrecting it, and beating it down again. And he was really able to, you know, to really go a lot further than anyone has, because he was willing to stand on the shoulder of giants, and really taking the past music and the past trends and putting them, completing them in a state that, you know, that wouldn't have been able to be reached if there wasn't already that prior knowledge. So instead of just saying, oh, that's done and we're going to move on, he said, it's not done. It hasn't even begun. You guys haven't even begun to reach the possibilities of fugues and counterpoint and all of the possibilities. And I want to talk about counterpoint for a second. I tell this to my music students. Every time you hear the word Bach, I want you to think of counterpoint. And every time you hear someone talk about counterpoint, I want you to think about Bach. That is not to say that Bach is the only person to use counterpoint, counterpoint, you know, made its way all the way into the end of the Romantic era, and even 20th century composers will use counterpoint. The counterpoint, literally, musically speaking, is two or more independent melody lines. A counterpoint, if you think about, if I make a point and you make a counterpoint, I say a statement and you say a different contrasting statement, and if we were to both say them at the same time, that would be what is called counterpoint. And in music, we have two melody lines, and I want to get this a little bit more in detail. The amazing thing about counterpoint is that not only are the melody lines beautiful in a horizontal way, but they are also beautiful in a vertical way, in the sense that the two melody lines going also line up so that at each moment in time they are not only creating a beautiful chord, but they are creating a beautiful chord progression. And this style of writing, which is in a way very restricting, but when you can get through the hoops, can actually be very liberating in other ways. Where we have, you know, the liberation comes from the insistent on the differentiation of the two melodies. We're also, you know, we're creating a harmony and a melody at the same time. And Bach was a Lutheran. Bach loved Martin Luther's approach to Christianity. And he was, I believe he was very religious. There are people who say that he wasn't as religious and he was more into the music. I think that Bach was definitely more into music than religion. I think he was more into music than anything, any of his family or any of his wives. But I still think that religion was an important part of everybody's life. And I think that the place that he was at really, made it possible for him to be religious. And I think that, and coming to the idea of the religion, and here's where we get into a little bit of the weird speculation, which is almost inevitable with Bach, is that when we have the vertical and the horizontal moving together, that forms the cross, and we have the symbol of Christianity encoded into Bach's music. And one of the, not necessarily on where I was going originally, but Bach tends to lend himself to these numerological numerology, analytical, conspiracy, where people say that he's used a certain amount of measures and there's a certain amount of symbolism. And I suppose you could do that with any music. You could open up any book to any page and you could say that a number meant a certain thing. But for some reason, people seem to be doing this with Bach more than other composers. And Bach seems to lend himself to this kind of analysis better, which is one explanation could be because Bach was putting different numbers into his music, measure numbers and various kinds of things. And, you know, an example of speculation would be the Bach Chaconne, which is the last movement of the D minor partita for violin, which has 64 variations, which is a nice round number. We have the first 21 variations are all melodic, and then going into the 22nd variation, we have arpeggios. And of course, there's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. The theme arrives back at the 32nd variation, and by the 33rd variation, we think that it ends on the 33, on the 33rd variation, but it actually continues forward and modulates to D major, and 33 is a very important number. Water changes temperatures at 32 to 33 degrees. It's said that Jesus did 33 miracles in the New Testament, and there are other 33, you can look into that yourself. The piece moves on until the 52nd variation, where it changes back to minor. Of course, there are 52 decks in 52 cards in your typical deck. There are 52 weeks in a year. There are 52 constellations in the southern hemisphere. And this is just an example of how people would apply these numerology aspects of Bach into his music. So are these numbers important, or is it just, of course, he landed on 32 because that's half of 64 and the 22 was a coincidence? And if you look hard enough, I suppose you can find anything. I don't have an answer to that. I'm not going to say that I think that that stuff is legitimate or illegitimate. I've heard, various arguments in all kinds of different things. Elliot pointed out that saying that Bach was using fractals is like saying that Bach drove a Corvette. Like, they didn't have Corvettes back then. They didn't have fractals back then. But at the same time, there are pieces of music that exactly are fractal-like. My brother is a math major, and I asked him about this. I would say, would you say that this is a fractal? And he said, no, it's fractal-like. It would be a piece of a fractal. If the same pattern was continuously repeated in the lower and higher levels, I suppose it might have been a fractal. But that's the other thing, is this mathematical analysis where there are fractals in Bach. There are things where Bach will take a theme and turn it upside down. Bach will take a theme and then end up playing it backwards, play it upside down and backwards, and end up sometimes playing them at the same time and having that end up being beautiful melodies. He'll take a melody and he'll slow it down to halftime and write counterpoint against that, or he'll write it in double time. There's so many unbelievable things that Bach does. Now, eventually we get to this, someone's thinking that these are really interesting mathematical games. He definitely played some kind of mathematical and counterpoint games, and it's hard to even really know if he, I don't even know if he knows how beautiful his music is. There's so many patterns in Bach. You can study a piece of Bach for your whole life, and you will always see something new. It's a lot like a Monty Python movie. Like, you can't just watch it once and say, okay, I got it. You have to see it. The more you see it, the more you get, and the more you get, the more you see. And I can't imagine that there is an end. There might be an end. Bach's music, when I typically learn a piece of music, I analyze it. I analyze the chord progression, and I study it. For example, I studied the Raindrop Prelude by Chopin. I have a guitar arrangement in A major arranged by Francisco Tárrega, And I was able to analyze that, and in a couple of days I was able to have a complete understanding of how the piece of music was put together. And not to say that I know everything about it, but there was very, you know, like there were a couple more rocks to unturn, and maybe I haven't delved too deep, but it seemed like most of the, I had a pretty good understanding of what was happening, and there was very little that was going on in the piece that I wasn't noticing or perceiving. And I even, me and Shankarian hung out with that piece a little bit too. But with Bach, I studied this piece I've studied every piece for years and years and years, and I still see new things every time. I'm amazed. There's so many sequences within sequences and patterns within patterns. But coming back to my other point, because we're getting, you know, this is all very rational kind of stuff. And eventually, someone would say, well, Bach's music is rational math games, and that it sounds pretty emotionless. And the way that I am describing it, you know, you would assume that too. But I have heard many Bach scholars say, and I agree with this, that Bach is the most intellectually stimulating music and also the most emotionally moving music. And that is one of the most amazing things about Bach. I think the most emotionally moving moment in Bach is the second movement of Brandenburg Concerto No. 1. That is just so haunting, the way that the lines are wrung out and then another line will change while there's these beautiful suspensions. And that, to me, is one of the most emotional things I've ever heard out of any musician. I think I got something in my eye every time I hear it. Beautiful piece of music. And to say that it's only a pure rational thing, I think, is to ignore the actual sound of it. And I think that a lot of Bach scholars, and I'm probably guilty of this too, get so into the rationalizing of it, to the the understanding it. The fact that you could study it your whole life and not understand it makes you want to try to understand it. Where the emotional beauty of it, where maybe you don't have to understand it, and let the just play the music and let it make its own statement. However, I will say, to quote Roland Deans, who unfortunately passed away recently, a great classical guitar player, I was watching a masterclass with him, and he pointed out that if you have the intention, then you'll do it. You don't have to try to play a note loud. If you can hear a song and you hear that that note needs to be louder, you will play it louder. The reason you don't play it louder is because you didn't hear it as needing to be louder. And the second that you can take an honest listen at yourself and have the intention, a lot of times your hand will work it out themselves. And I think that that's definitely a good approach. So under this light, we would realize that the better we understand the music, the more emotional the music is going to come out, if we assume that that's true. And through my experience, I have found that that is very, very, very true. And that unless you notice something, it's going to be very difficult to get anyone else to notice it in a piece of music. So the game that Bach plays with you then is really a spiritual thing too, because we're trying to balance now in ourselves. The music of Bach forces us to balance within ourselves the emotional and the rational components. Because if we become too rational, we forget about the emotion. If we become too emotional, we forget about what we're going to be emotional about. And it's truly amazing that not only that Bach has reached such an intellectual and emotional height in his own whatever, when you play his music too, he forces you up into that higher level of rational and emotional balance. And not necessarily the indulgence in one or the other. So he really, I have said this myself, and I have heard other people say that playing Bach has made me a better person. It's made me a better person, and I think, and you have to learn a piece by Bach, a real piece, not like some G minuet or something. Learn a real piece by Bach, and you will see what I mean. That's really the only way to say it. But, excuse me, to hint at that a little bit, you know, part of that is because you learn to balance the rational and the emotional things. And you learn to take a rational thing and make it emotional. And you learn to take an emotional thing and make it into a, make it be able to rationalize it so that you can have both sides of your brain operating at the same time, both sides of the temple, and not just the one or the other. And of course, the only way to get through the gates is to pass through both, pass through the two sides of the two pillars of the temple. A little bit of mysticism there for you. And of course, this is about Bach, and you can't, everybody has to mention mysticism, whether or not you're debunking it or saying, Bach, put this in here because of Jesus and the number. I have to bring that up anyway, and I'm having a little bit of fun anyway. I hope this is enjoyable for you guys as much as educational. Bach, I want to talk about Bach's solo works in particular, and Bach's works for classical guitar specifically, because that is my expertise as a classical guitar player. I would say probably my expertise in classical guitar is in Bach and a lot of Villa-Lobos as well, but I probably spend the most time really loving Bach, and Villa-Lobos is really more of my guitar teacher. And Bach is my lover, so to speak. I hate to bring the jokes in. But, so what Bach was able to do on solo instruments was a really incredible thing, which can be, I've heard described as implied counterpoint, or really just having a single melody line that incorporates multiple melody lines within it, usually distinguished by a large jump. Apologize for the singing, but you can hear that in that part there were actually three distinct melody lines. And then a dun 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 dun. And then and you can hear that even in the first measure of the first prelude, that Bach is already on a solo instrument, one note at a time, creating an illusion of three note counterpoint, three individual melody lines moving at the same time. And nobody could write solo music in the classical style like Bach. And most solo instruments are really, really interested in Bach. In fact, as a classical guitar player, Bach is one of the few truly legitimate composers that I can really get my hands around. I can play a Chopin transcription I mentioned earlier. There might be a Moonlight Sonata coming out, you know, maybe a little Clair de Lune, little slow thing, but just the one section. But Bach is a composer that I can really play in an authentic way without having to smush octaves, without having to change the key, although we do that anyway, but without, you know, like, without having to really make a transcription. When you anytime you're playing a piece by, you know, you're making a transcription from piano. It was written on piano and you're doing the best you can on guitar. Or it was written in orchestra and you know... somehow you come up with something. so that's the more of the transcription. But Bach really has music that you can play on the guitar that's really his own music. So we can really get, even for a solo instrument, even solo flute, violin, cello, we can really get inside the mind of a master from a view more of a conductor, because we are the, when you're playing a solo work and you're controlling three voices, you sort of have this view almost from above, where you're looking at these three melodies as if you were in the sky looking down at three different sort of things, which is of course the part of the architecture of not necessarily that time period, but the time period preceding, which is certainly could be an influence. So now that we have looked at the three different voices as distinct, this brings us into the question, well, how do we bring out these different voices, and the question of interpretation. I have a little black book of Elliot Fisk secrets, and one of the things that I wrote down, I thought this was important enough to write down, and Elliot has said this many times and stressed this in many ways, nobody knows the correct way to play Bach. The idea that there is a correct way to play Bach, so I want to kind of talk about this too, because there's this sort of belief that everybody in this certain period all played music exactly the same way all the time, and then right at the year that the classical movement was created, everybody suddenly all did anything different, and there was no overlap, and there was no vagueness, and if you think about someone saying that about today, just, you know, everybody liked Britney Spears, or everybody likes Justin Bieber. And I suppose that in a sense it is true that everybody likes... I don't like Justin Bieber. I don't know anyone who does. So when we're talking about, like, these kinds of things... Now, Baroque music, too, was also very much an improvised nature, where most Baroque composers actually would write very simple things, and it was implied in the style that the person would improvise things. And there's plenty of books that show, like, what the music looks like and what a person would actually play, and it's unbelievably elaborate, you know, definitely comparable to the jazz musicians from the 30s up to the 60s, of just a highly elaborate, you know, getting into crazy things while still maintaining the underlying melody, but doing highly, highly elaborate, ornamenting it even more. Now, I've also heard a lot of people, scholars, saying that a lot of people in the day, in Bach's day, were saying that his music was too detailed, and that he hardly left any room at all for the person to improvise, or to do fantasy, as they called it, fantasia. So getting into the interpretation of Bach, just a couple suggestions and some ideas are using different dynamics, tones, and articulations to distinguish between different voices, even just purely as an exercise in its own sake, but also as a way of coming up with your own way of interpreting music, or differing the interpretation. So, for example, the bass voice might be played in a very dark tone, while the other voices are played in a brighter tone, maybe closer to the bridge. So that is one way where you can distinguish between the tone of different voices. You might make an inner voice staccato, which also brings out that other voice. One of Elliot's great secrets is to when a note is ringing while another note is moving within Bach, Elliot will play that second voice staccato. So if you have da da bum 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 da 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 bum. Boom, boom. And it really highlights the implied two voices that happen in the, you know, and it really is a way to highlight the, give each voice its own character. I think the master of this is Julian Brahms. I'm always amazed at how, when he plays any counterpoint, that each voice has its own tone, has its own, almost its own personality. It almost seems like some voices are a little bit more stubborn and clumsier, and some voices are a little bit more laid back and mellow. And the other thing that amazes me is that once a voice, whatever that personality tone, whatever it is established within a certain voice, he's able to maintain that throughout the whole piece, so that people don't suddenly change. And I don't really know how he does that. I don't know if anybody knows. I don't even, you know, maybe him and like two other, you know, if anyone, you know, I would love to hear any input on that. I think part of it is the tone, part of it is the articulation, part of it is the fingering. I think it's probably the combination of a number of elements. But I think most of all, it would be just his very keen ability to hear what he is actually playing, which sounds like a simple thing, but is very difficult for most musicians to actually do. Elliot would continuously correct me, because when you have the idea in your head, you hear it so loudly that you can't actually hear what is in your actual mind, you can't actually hear what you're actually playing because you have this beautiful tone in your head, and the noise in your head is so loud you think that you actually sound the way that you do in your head, but you don't. And you very rarely do. If you can actually really carefully listen to what is actually coming out of your own instrument, and maybe take the bias away for a little bit, and then say, how can I change that to get, it's a very difficult thing to do. It's very hard to realize that you don't sound the way that you think you sound. So the interpretations of Bach have been, there's so many different things. So I want to talk about a couple issues. See, that, these scholars have actually created issues and arguments on Bach, and I definitely have to touch on a couple of them. First of all, the idea, I'm going to bounce and forth, but I'm going to kind of create an argument. So first of all, I'm going to say that Bach's music is dance, a lot of Bach's music is dance music, and it is meant to be played rhythmically with a metronome. Now, I could argue against that, and I could say that the metronome wasn't actually created until Beethoven was interested in, gave the guy an idea, so we didn't even have a metronome. And also the idea that not all dance music was necessarily metronomic, and that a lot of dances, like the waltz, actually had fluctuations that would go up and down, and the style of the dance itself had variations in tempos. A lot of super Bach nerds will actually learn how to do the Allemande and the Courante and the Sarabande, and they'll actually learn these dances. And at least having a little bit of a sense of how they move, which you can do, or if you just play a number of different suites, you start to get an idea of the feel of each one of these kinds of things. I think a dance suite is really an impressive, eclectic variety. As much as Bach was playing in the old style, there was really a lot of variety that he was able to put into each one of these different characters. When you look at even a given suite, and if you look at the different character, sometimes it's hard to even believe that it was the same composer who wrote both of these pieces of music, because they're so strikingly different, not in the in methodology, but in character and approach and style, where Bach will be very aggressive in one style and then very subtle and laid back, where he only gives you a little bit. He can be shy and he can be, and then another time he can be unbelievably direct. I've also found, studying at least the lute suites, that literally Bach does not do the same thing twice. The way that Bach ends a phrase, he does not end any phrase the same way in any other movement. The way that Bach starts the piece is different in every movement. If Bach does a cool thing in one piece, in one Allemande, he doesn't do it in another Allemande. So I think that he is almost deliberately trying to put new things in. I think that he was, I believe, this is speculative now, that he was actually looking at what he did before and then was really trying to demonstrate a different thing where he, now, definitely at its core, Bach uses a lot of the same moves. The neighbor group, which is where you play a note, you play the note above, you play the note below, and you go back. Or maybe you play the note, you play the note below, you play the note above, and you go back. For example, da na da na or ba the neighbor group. Bach, that's like half of what Bach did. So there are definitely cells and tendencies. If you play enough Bach, you can really get a sense of his licks and his styles. His music imagination is unlimited, but his little licks and his little tendencies were just as limited as anybody else. I think we all have our own little licks and our own little tendencies, but that doesn't limit my imagination. You know, for example, if I have an amazing story, I might have a different set of adjectives as a different writer, or I might describe something in a different way. But that is not to belittle the actual creativity of the story itself. It's just as a storyteller, if I have a British accent, for example, it's going to sound British, and that's, you know, like you're... That's how, and it, if you don't have a British accent, it won't, you know, or however it is. So I think that Bach is a human being. I have, if you really deep dig, you know, down enough, I think that he actually is a single human being. And it's just one who worked unbelievably hard and knew, I think that he always knew that his music was going to go down in history as some of the greatest music ever written, and it certainly has. You know, Bach has not been around for a long time, and people are still talking about, and people are still learning more, and people want more. People want to learn more. People are trying to find new approaches, new ways of doing it, and I think that's an exciting thing. Bach's music is alive. You know, they talk about the scripture as being the living word in Christianity, and I believe that Bach's music is an embodiment of the living music. Bach's music is alive, and it's evolving, and it's being ornamented and being re-ornamented. And it's a truly amazing achievement is just to be able to have this output of such varying styles, religious music, secular music, dance music, so many different things. One more thing that I want to end with, because there is this, a lot of people say, and I think even in Wikipedia it says that Bach wrote more music than any person in human history. Over 1,000 works. Bach wrote an unbelievable amount of works. I read a lot of articles. Telemann did write 2,000 works. Telemann has actually written more works than Bach. I love Bach, but I'm not going to ignore historical facts. Unfortunately, Telemann has actually written more music, and I have heard from a number of Baroque connoisseurs that Telemann is actually the man to check out, and that I'm really missing out, and I probably am. But there's only so much you can do with your life, and of course, now that I mentioned that, I have to point out that Telemann was supposed to get, you know, there was the big job that Bach wanted to get, and Telemann was supposed to get it. Bach ended up getting it, and, you know, I think that it ended up being that Bach wasn't necessarily the best people person, and that had gave him a little bit of trouble in his life, too, but I think his music spoke past that. So anyway, have a good night. Thanks for listening.